were already seeing to the wounded. But he shook his head and stood there unaided. In shock, he was talkative, and his voice was softer. ME-109. Must have been his machine gun. The cannon would have blown my ruddy hand off. 20mm, you know. He must have strayed from his group, spotted us on his way home and couldn't resist. Can't blame him, really. But it means there'll be more of them pretty soon. The half-dozen men he had gathered up before had picked themselves and their rifles out of the ditch and were wandering off. The sight of them recalled the Major to himself.
All right, chaps, form up.
They seemed quite unable to resist him and formed a line. Trembling a little now, he addressed Turner.
And you three, at the double.
Actually, old boy, to tell the truth, I think we'd rather not.
Oh, I see.
He squinted at Turner's shoulder, seeming to see there the insignia of senior rank. He gave a good-natured salute with his left hand.
In that case, sir, if you don't mind, we'll be off. Wish us luck.
Good luck, Major. They watched him march his reluctant detachment away towards the woods, where the machine guns waited. For half an hour, the column did not move. Turner put himself at the disposal of the RAMC captain and helped on the stretcher parties, bringing in the wounded. Afterward, he found places for them on the lorries. There was no sign of the corporals. He fetched and carried supplies from the back of an ambulance. Watching the captain at work, stitching a head wound, Turner felt the stirrings of his old ambitions. The quantity of blood obscured the textbook details he remembered. Along their stretch of road, there were 5 injured, and surprisingly no one dead, though the sergeant with the rifle was hit in the face and was not expected to live. 3 vehicles had their front end shot up and were pushed off the road. The petrol was siphoned off, and for good measure bullets were fired through the tyres. When all this was done in their section, there was still no movement up at the front of the column. Turner retrieved his greatcoat and walked on. He was too thirsty to wait about. An elderly Belgian lady, shot in the knee, had drunk the last of his water. His tongue was large in his mouth, and all he could think of now was finding a drink. That, and keeping a watch on the sky. He passed sections like his own where vehicles were being disabled and the wounded were being lifted into lorries. He had been going for 10 minutes when he saw Mace's head on the grass by a pile of dirt. It was about 25 yards away, in the deep green shadow of a stand of poplars. He went toward it, even though he suspected that it would be better for his state of mind to walk on. He found Mace and Nettle shoulder-deep in a hole. They were in the final stages of digging a grave. Lying face down beyond the pile of earth was a boy of 15 or so, a crimson stain on the back of his white shirt spread from neck to waist. Mace leaned on his shovel and did a passable imitation.
I think we'd rather not.
Very good, Governor. I'll remember that next time.
Divagation was nice. Where'd you get that one?
He swallowed a fucking dictionary,
Corporal Nettle said proudly.
I used to like the crossword.
And horribly and onerously overrun.
There was a concert party they had in the sergeant's mess last Christmas.
Still in the grave, he and Nettle sang tunelessly for Turner's benefit.
'Twas ostensibly ominous in the overview to be horribly and onerously overrun.
Behind them, the column was beginning to move.
Better stick him in, Corporal Mace said.
The 3 men lifted the boy down and set him on his back. Clipped to his shirt pocket was a row of fountain pens. The corporals didn't pause for ceremony. They began to shovel in the dirt, and soon the boy had vanished. Nettle said,
Nice looking kid.
The corporals had bound 2 tent poles with twine to make a cross. Nettle banged it in with the back of his shovel. As soon as it was done, they walked back to the road.
Mace said, "He was with his grandparents. They didn't want him left in the ditch. I thought they'd come over and see him off, like, but they're in a terrible state. We better tell them where he is."
But the boy's grandparents were not to be seen. As they walked on, Turner took out the map and said,
"Keep watching the sky."
The major was right. After the Messerschmitt's casual pass, they would be back. They should have been back by now. The Berg Fern Canal was marked in thick, bright blue on his map. Turner's impatience to reach it had become inseparable from his thirst. He would put his face in that blue and drink deeply. This thought put him in mind of childhood fevers, their wild and frightening logic, the search for the cool corner of the pillow, and his mother's hand upon his brow. Dear Grace. When he touched his own forehead, the skin was papery and dry. The inflammation round his wound, he sensed, was growing, and the skin was becoming tighter, harder, with something, not blood, leaking out of it onto his shirt. He wanted to examine himself in private, but that was hardly possible here. The convoy was moving at its old, inexorable pace. Their road ran straight to the coast. There would be no shortcuts now. As they drew closer, the black cloud, which surely came from a burning refinery in Dunkirk, was beginning to rule the northern sky. There was nothing to do but walk toward it. So he settled once more into silent, head-down trudging. The road no longer had the protection of the plane trees. Vulnerable to attack and without shade, it uncoiled across the undulating land in long, shallow S-shapes. He had wasted precious reserves in unnecessary talk and encounters. Tiredness had made him superficially elated and forthcoming. Now he reduced his progress to the rhythm of his boots. He walked across the land until he came to the sea. Everything that impeded him had to be outweighed, even if only by a fraction, by all that drove him on. In one pan of the scales, his wound, thirst, the blister, tiredness, the heat, the aching in his feet and legs, the Stukas, the distance, the channel. In the other, "I'll wait for you." And the memory of when she had said it, which he had come to treat like a sacred sight. Also the fear of capture. His most sensual memories, their few minutes in the library, the kiss in Whitehall, were bleached colourless through overuse. He knew by heart certain passages from her letters. He had revisited their tussle with the vase by the fountain. He remembered the warmth from her arm at the dinner when the twins went missing. These memories sustained him, but not so easily. Too often they reminded him of where he was when he last summoned them. They lay on the far side of a great divide in time, as significant as BC and AD, before prison, before the war, before the sight of a corpse became a banality. But these heresies died when he read her last letter. He touched his breast pocket. It was a kind of genuflection. Still there. Here was something new on the scales. That he could be cleared had all the simplicity of love. Merely tasting the possibility reminded him how much had narrowed and died. His taste for life, no less, all the old ambitions and pleasures. The prospect was of a rebirth, a triumphant return. He could become again the man who had once crossed a Surrey Park at dusk in his best suit, swaggering on the promise of life, who had entered the house and with the clarity of passion made love to Cecilia. No, let him rescue the word from the corporals. They had fucked while others sipped their cocktails on the terrace. The story could resume, the one that he had been planning on that evening walk. He and Cecilia would no longer be isolated. Their love would have space and a society to grow in. He would not go about cap in hand to collect apologies from the friends who had shunned him. Nor would he sit back, proud and fierce, shunning them in return. He knew exactly how he would behave. He would simply resume. With his criminal record struck off, he could apply to medical college when the war was over, or even go for a commission now in the medical corps. If Cecilia made her peace with her family, he would keep his distance without seeming sour. He could never be on close terms with Emily or Jack. She had pursued his prosecution with a strange ferocity, while Jack turned away, vanished into his ministry the moment he was needed. None of that mattered. From here it looked simple. They were passing more bodies in the road, in the gutters, and on the pavement, dozens of them, soldiers and civilians. The stench was cruel, insinuating itself into the folds of his clothes. The convoy had entered a bombed village, or perhaps the suburb of a small town. The place was rubble, and it was impossible to tell. Who would care? Who could ever describe this confusion and come up with the village names and the dates for the history books? And take the reasonable view and begin to assign the blame? No one would ever know what it was like to be here. Without the details, there could be no larger picture. The abandoned stores, equipment and vehicles made an avenue of scrap that spilled across their path. With this and the bodies, they were forced to walk in the centre of the road. That did not matter because the convoy was no longer moving. Soldiers were climbing out of troop carriers and continuing on foot, stumbling over brick and roof tiles. The wounded were left in the lorries to wait. There was a greater press of bodies in a narrower space, greater irritation. Turner kept his head down and followed the man in front, protectively folded in his thoughts. He would be cleared. From the way it looked here, where you could hardly be bothered to lift your feet to step over a dead woman's arm, he did not think he would be needing apologies or tributes. To be cleared would be a pure state. He dreamed of it like a lover, with a simple longing. He dreamed of it in the way other soldiers dreamed of their hearths or allotments or old civilian jobs. If innocence seemed elemental here, there was no reason why it should not be so back in England. Let his name be cleared, then let everyone else adjust their thinking. He had put in time, now they must do the work. His business was simple. Find Cecilia and love her, marry her, and live without shame. But there was one part in all this that he could not think through, one indistinct shape that the shambles 12 miles outside Dunkirk could not reduce to a simple outline. Bryony. Here he came against the outer edge of what Cecilia called his generous spirit and his rationality. If Cecilia were to be reunited with her family, if the sisters were close again, there would be no avoiding her. But could he accept her? Could he be in the same room? Here she was, offering a possibility of absolution. But it was not for him. He had done nothing wrong. It was for herself, for her own crime which her conscience could no longer bear. Was he supposed to feel grateful? And yes, of course, she was a child in 1935. He had told himself, he and Cecilia had told each other over and again. Yes, she was just a child. But not every child sends a man to prison with a lie. Not every child is so purposeful and malign, so consistent over time, never wavering, never doubted. A child. But that had not stopped him daydreaming in his cell of her humiliation, of a dozen ways he might find revenge. In France once, in the bitterest week of winter, raging drunk on cognac, he had even conjured her onto the end of his bayonet. Bryony and Danny Hardman. It was not reasonable or just to hate Bryony, but it helped. How to begin to understand this child's mind? Only one theory held up. There was a day in June 1932, all the more beautiful for coming suddenly after a long spell of rain and wind. It was one of those rare mornings which declares itself with a boastful extravagance of warmth and light and new leaves as the true beginning, the grand portal to summer. And he was walking through it with Bryony, past the Triton Pond, down beyond the ha-ha and rhododendrons, through the iron kissing gate, and on to the winding, narrow woodland path. She was excited and talkative. She would have been about 10 years old, just starting to write her little stories. Along with everyone else, he had received his own bound and illustrated tale of love, adversities overcome, reunion and a wedding. They were on their way down to the river for the swimming lesson he had promised her. As they left the house behind, she may have been telling him about a story she had just finished or a book she was reading. She may have been holding his hand. She was a quiet, intense little girl, rather prim in her way, and this outpouring was unusual. He was happy to listen. These were exciting times for him, too. He was 19. Exams were almost over, and he thought he'd done well. Soon he would cease to be a schoolboy. He had interviewed well at Cambridge, and in 2 weeks he was leaving for France, where he was to teach English at a religious school. There was a grandeur about the day, about the colossal, barely stirring beeches and oaks, and the light that dropped like jewels through the fresh foliage to make pools among last year's dead leaves. This magnificence, he sensed in his youthful self-importance, reflected the glorious momentum of his life. She prattled on, and contentedly he half listened. The path emerged from the woods onto the broad grassy banks of the river. They walked upstream for half a mile and entered woods again. Here, on a bend in the river, below overhanging trees, was the pool, dug out in Bryony's grandfather's time. A stone weir slowed the current and was a favourite diving and jumping-off place. Otherwise, it was not ideal for beginners. You went from the weir, or you jumped off the bank into 9 feet of water. He dived in and trod water, waiting for her. They had started the lessons the year before, in late summer, when the river was lower and the current sluggish. Now, even in the pool, there was a steady, rotating drift. She paused only for a moment, then jumped from the bank into his arms with a scream. She practiced treading water until the current carried her against the weir. Then he towed her across the pool so that she could start again. When she tried out her breaststroke after a winter of neglect, he had to support her, not easy when he was treading water himself. If he moved his hand from under her, she could only manage 3 or 4 strokes before sinking. She was amused by the fact that, going against the current, she swam to remain still. But she did not stay still. Instead, she was carried back each time to the weir, where she clung to a rusty iron ring, waiting for him, her white face vivid against the lurid, mossy walls and greenish cement. Swimming uphill, she called it. She wanted to repeat the experience, but the water was cold, and after 15 minutes he'd had enough. He pulled her over to the bank and, ignoring her protests, helped her out. He took his clothes from the basket and went a little way off into the woods to change. When he returned, she was standing exactly where he had left her, on the bank, looking into the water, with her towel around her shoulders. She said, "If I fell in the river, would you save me?" "Of course." He was bending over the basket as he said this, and he heard, but did not see, her jump in. Her towel lay on the bank. Apart from the concentric ripples moving out across the pool, there was no sign of her. Then she bobbed up, snatched a breath, and sank again. Desperate, he thought of running to the weir to fish her out from there, but the water was an opaque, muddy green. He would only find her below the surface by touch. There was no choice. He stepped into the water, shoes, jacket and all. Almost immediately he found her arm, got his hand under her shoulder and heaved her up. To his surprise, she was holding her breath. And then she was laughing joyously and clinging to his neck. He pushed her onto the bank and, with great difficulty in his sodden clothes, struggled out himself.
"Thank you," she kept saying. "Thank you, thank you."
That was a bloody stupid thing to do.
"I wanted you to save me."
"Don't you know how easily you could have drowned?"
"You saved me."
Distress and relief were charging his anger. He was close to shouting.
"You stupid girl! You could have killed us both!"
She fell silent. He sat on the grass, emptying the water from his shoes. "You went under the surface. I couldn't see you. My clothes were weighing me down. We could have drowned, both of us. Is it your idea of a joke?"
"Well, is it?"
There was nothing more to say. She got dressed and they went back along the path. Bryony first, and he squelching behind her. He wanted to get into the open sunlight of the park. Then he faced a long trudge back to the bungalow for a change of clothes. He had not yet spent his anger. She was not too young, he thought, to get her mind around an apology. She walked in silence, head lowered, possibly sulking, he could not see. When they came out of the woods and had gone through the kissing gate, she stopped and turned. Her tone was forthright, even defiant. Rather than sulk, she was squaring up to him.
"Do you know why I wanted you to save me?"
"No."
"Isn't it obvious?"
"No, it isn't."
"Because I love you."
She said it bravely, with chin upraised, and she blinked rapidly as she spoke, dazzled by the momentous truth she had revealed. He restrained an impulse to laugh. He was the object of a schoolgirl crush.
"What on earth do you mean by that?" "I mean what everybody else means when they say it. I love you."
This time the words were on a pathetic rising note. He realized that he should resist the temptation to mock, but it was difficult. He said, "You love me, so you threw yourself in the river."
"I wanted to know if you'd save me."
"And now you know. I'd risk my life for yours. But that doesn't mean I love you." She drew herself up a little.
"I want to thank you for saving my life. I'll be eternally grateful to you."
Line surely from one of her books, one she had read lately or one she had written. He said, "That's all right. But don't do it again, for me or anyone else. Promise?" She nodded and said in parting,
"I love you. Now you know."
She walked away toward the house. Shivering in the sunlight, he watched her until she was out of sight, and then he set off for home. He did not see her on her own before he left for France, and by the time he came back in September, she was away at boarding school. Not long after, he went up to Cambridge, and in December spent Christmas with friends. He didn't see Bryony until the following April, and by then the matter was forgotten. Or was it? He'd had plenty of time alone, too much time, to consider. He could remember no other unusual conversation with her, no strange behaviour, no meaningful looks or sulks to suggest that her schoolgirlish passion had lasted beyond that day in June. He had been back to Surrey almost every vacation, and she had many opportunities to seek him out at the bungalow or pass him a note. He was busy with his new life then, lost to the novelties of undergraduate life, and also intent at that time on putting a little distance between himself and the Tallis family. But there must have been signs which he had not noticed. For 3 years she must have nurtured a feeling for him, kept it hidden, nourished it with fantasy or embellished it in her stories. She was the sort of girl who lived in her thoughts. The drama by the river might have been enough to sustain her all that time. This theory, or conviction, rested on the memory of a single encounter, the meeting at dusk on the bridge. For years he had dwelled on that walk across the park. She would have known he was invited to dinner. There she was, barefoot, in a dirty white frock. That was strange enough. She would have been waiting for him, perhaps preparing her little speech, even rehearsing it out loud as she sat on the stone parapet. When he finally arrived, she was tongue-tied. That was proof of a sort. Even at the time, he thought it odd that she did not speak to him. He gave her the letter and she ran off. Minutes later, she was opening it. She was shocked, and not only by a word. In her mind, he had betrayed her love by favouring her sister. Then, in the library, confirmation of the worst, at which point the whole fantasy crashed. First, disappointment and despair, then a rising bitterness. Finally, an extraordinary opportunity in the dark, during the search for the twins, to avenge herself. She named him, and no one but her sister and his mother doubted her. The impulse, the flash of malice, the infantile destructiveness he could understand. The wonder was the depth of the girl's rancor, her persistence with a story that saw him all the way to Wandsworth Prison. Now he might be cleared, and that gave him joy. He acknowledged the courage it would require for her to go back to the law and deny the evidence she had given under oath. But he did not think his resentment of her could ever be erased. Yes, she was a child at the time, and he did not forgive her. He would never forgive her. That was the lasting damage. There was more confusion ahead, more shouting. Incredibly, an armoured column was forcing its way against the forward press of traffic, soldiers and refugees. The crowd parted reluctantly. People squeezed into the gaps between abandoned vehicles or against shattered walls and doorways. It was a French column, hardly more than a detachment, three armoured cars, two half-tracks and two troop carriers. There was no show of common cause. Among the British troops, the view was that the French had let them down. No will to fight for their own country. Irritated at being pushed aside, the Tommies swore and taunted their allies with shouts of Maginot. For their part, the poilus must have heard rumours of an evacuation. And here they were being sent to cover the rear. Cowards, to the boats! Go shit in your pants! Then they were gone, and the crowd closed in again under a cloud of diesel smoke and walked on. They were approaching the last houses in the village. In a field ahead, he saw a man and his collie dog walking behind a horse-drawn plough. Like the ladies in the shoe shop, the farmer did not seem aware of the convoy. These lives were lived in parallel. War was a hobby for the enthusiasts, and no less serious for that. Like the deadly pursuit of a hunt to hounds, while over the next hedge a woman in the back seat of a passing motor car was absorbed in her knitting, and in the bare garden of a new house a man was teaching his son to kick a ball. Yes, the ploughing would still go on, and there'd be a crop, someone to reap it and mill it, others to eat it. And not everyone would be dead. Turner was thinking this when Nettle gripped his arm and pointed. The commotion of the passing French column had covered the sound, but they were easy enough to see. There were at least 15 of them at 10,000 feet, little dots in the blue circling above the road. Turner and the corporal stopped to watch, and everyone nearby saw them too. An exhausted voice murmured close to his ear, "Fuck, where's the RAF?" Another said knowingly, "They'll go for the frogs." As if goaded into disproof, one of the specks peeled away and began its near-vertical dive directly above their heads. For seconds the sound did not reach them. The silence was building like pressure in their ears. Even the wild shouts that went up and down the road did not relieve it. Take cover! Disperse! Disperse! At the double! It was difficult to move. He could walk on at a steady trudge, and he could stop. But it was an effort of memory to reach for the unfamiliar commands, to turn away from the road and run. They had stopped by the last house in the village. Beyond the house was a barn, and flanking both was the field where the farmer had been ploughing. Now he was standing under a tree with his dog, as though sheltering from a shower of rain. His horse, still in harness, grazed along the unploughed strip. Soldiers and civilians were streaming away from the road in all directions. A woman brushed past him carrying a crying child. Then she changed her mind and came back and stood turning indecisively at the side of the road. Which way? The farmyard or the field? Her immobility delivered him from his own. As he pushed her by the shoulder toward the gate, the rising howl commenced. Nightmares had become a science. Someone, a mere human, had taken the time to dream up this satanic howling. And what success! It was the sound of panic itself, mounting and straining toward the extinction they all knew, individually, to be theirs. It was a sound you were obliged to take personally. Turner guided the woman through the gate. He wanted her to run with him into the centre of the field. He had touched her and made her decision for her, so now he felt he could not abandon her. But the boy was at least 6 years old and heavy, and together they were making no progress at all. He dragged the child from her arms. "Come on!" he shouted. A Stuka carried a single 1,000-pound bomb. The idea on the ground was to get away from buildings, vehicles, and other people. The pilot was not going to waste his precious load on a lone figure in a field. When he turned back to strafe, it would be another matter. Turner had seen them hunt down a sprinting man for the sport of it. With a free hand, he was pulling on the woman's arm. The boy was wetting his pants and screaming in Turner's ear. The mother seemed incapable of running. She was stretching out her hand and shouting. She wanted her son back. The child was wriggling toward her across his shoulder. Now came the screech of the falling bomb. They said that if you heard the noise, stop before the explosion, your time was up. As he dropped to the grass, he pulled the woman with him and shoved her head down. He was half lying across the child as the ground shook to the unbelievable roar. The shockwave prized them from the earth. They covered their faces against the stinging spray of dirt. They heard the Stuka climb from its dive, even as they heard the banshee wail of the next attack. The bomb had hit the road less than 80 yards away. He had the boy under his arm, and he was trying to pull the woman to her feet. "We've got to run again. We're too close to the road." The woman answered, but he did not understand her. Again they were stumbling across the field. He felt the pain in his side like a flash of colour. The boy was in his arms, and again the woman seemed to be dragging back and trying to get her son from him. There were hundreds in the field now, all making for the woods on the far side. At the shrill whine of the bomb, everyone cowered on the ground. But the woman had no instinct for danger, and he had to pull her down again. This time they were pressing their faces into freshly turned earth. As the screech grew louder, the woman shouted what sounded like a prayer. He realized then that she wasn't speaking French. The explosion was on the far side of the road, more than 150 yards away. But now the first Stuka was turning over the village and dropping for the strafe. The boy had gone silent with shock. His mother wouldn't stand. Turner pointed to the Stuka coming in over the rooftops. They were right in its path, and there was no time for argument. She wouldn't move. He threw himself down into the furrow. The rippling thuds of machine gun fire in the ploughed earth and the engine roar flashed past them. A wounded soldier was screaming. Turner was on his feet, but the woman would not take his hand. She sat on the ground and hugged the boy tightly to her. She was speaking Flemish to him, soothing him, surely telling him that everything was going to be all right. Mama would see to that. Turner didn't know a single word of the language. It would have made no difference. She paid him no attention. The boy was staring at him blankly over his mother's shoulder. Turner took a step back. Then he ran. As he floundered across the furrows, the attack was coming in. The rich soil was clinging to his boots. Only in nightmares were feet so heavy. A bomb fell on the road, way over in the center of the village, where the lorries were. But one screech hit another, and it hit the field before he could go down. The blast lifted him forward several feet and drove him face first into the soil. When he came to, his mouth and nose and ears were filled with dirt. He was trying to clear his mouth, but he had no saliva. He used a finger, but that was worse. He was gagging on the dirt. Then he was gagging on his filthy finger. He blew the dirt from his nose. His snot was mud, and it covered his mouth. But the woods were near. There would be streams and waterfalls and lakes in there. He imagined a paradise. When the rising howl of a diving Stuka sounded again, he struggled to place the sound. Was it the all clear? His thoughts, too, were clogged. He could not spit or swallow. He could not easily breathe, and he could not think. Then, at the sight of the farmer with his dog still waiting patiently under the tree, it came back to him. He remembered everything, and he turned to look back. Where the woman and her son had been was a crater. Even as he saw it, he thought he had always known. That was why he had to leave them. His business was to survive, though he had forgotten why. He kept on toward the woods. He walked a few steps into the tree cover and sat in the new undergrowth with his back to a birch sapling. His only thought was of water. There were more than 200 people sheltering in the woods, including some wounded who had dragged themselves in. There was a man, a civilian not far off, crying and shouting in pain. Turner got up and moved further away. All the new greenery spoke to him only of water. The attack continued on the road and over the village. He cleared away old leaves and used his helmet to dig. The soil was damp, but no water oozed into the hole he had made, even when it was 18 inches deep. So he sat and thought about water and tried to clean his tongue against his sleeve. When a Stuka dived, it was impossible not to tense and shrink, though each time he thought he didn't have the strength. Toward the end, they came over to strafe the woods, but to no effect. Leaves and twigs tumbled from the canopy. Then the plains were gone, and in the huge silence that loomed over the fields and trees and the village, there was not even birdsong. After a while, from the direction of the road, came blasts of a whistle for the all clear. But no one moved. He remembered this from last time. They were too dazed. They were in shock from repeated episodes of terror. Each dive brought every man, cornered and cowering, to face his execution. When it did not come, the trial had to be lived through all over again, and the fear did not diminish. For the living, the end of a Stuka attack was the paralysis of shock, of repeated shocks. The sergeants and junior officers might come around shouting and kicking the men into standing, but they were drained, and for a good while, useless as troops. So he sat there in a daze like everyone else, just as he had the first time, outside the village whose name he could not remember, these French villages with Belgian names, when he was separated from his unit and, what was worse for an infantryman, from his rifle. How many days ago? There could be no way of knowing. He examined his revolver, which was clogged with dirt. He removed the ammunition and tossed the gun into the bushes. After a time, there was a sound behind him, and a hand was on his shoulder.
Here you go. Courtesy of the Green Howards.
Corporal Mace was passing him some dead man's water bottle. Since it was almost full, he used the first swig to rinse out his mouth, but that was a waste. He drank the dirt with the rest. Mace, you're an angel. The corporal extended a hand to pull him up.
Got to shift. There's a rumour the fucking Belgians have collapsed. We might get cut off from the east. Still miles to go.
As they were walking back across the field, Nettle joined them. He had a bottle of wine and an ammo bar, which they passed around.
Nice bouquet, Turner said when he had drunk deeply. Dead frog.
The peasant and his collie were back behind the plough. The three soldiers approached the crater where the smell of cordite was strong. The hole was a perfectly symmetrical inverted cone whose sides were smooth as though finely sieved and raked. There were no human signs, not a shred of clothing or shoe leather. Mother and child had been vaporized. He paused to absorb this fact, but the corporals were in a hurry and pushed him on, and soon they joined the stragglers on the road. It was easier now. There would be no traffic until the sappers took their bulldozers into the village. Ahead, the cloud of burning oil stood over the landscape like an angry father. High-flying bombers droned above, a steady two-way stream moving into and returning from their target. It occurred to Turner that he might be walking into a slaughter. But everyone was going that way, and he could think of no alternative. Their route was taking them well to the right of the cloud, to the east of Dunkirk, toward the Belgian border. Bray Dunes, he said, remembering the name from the map. Nettle said,
I like the sound of those.
They passed men who could barely walk for their blisters. Some were barefoot. A soldier with a bloody chest wound reclined in an ancient pram pushed by his mates. A sergeant was leading a cart horse over the back of which was draped an officer, unconscious or dead, his feet and wrists secured by ropes. Some troops were on bicycles. Most walked in twos or threes. A dispatch rider from the Highland Light Infantry came by on a Harley Davidson. His blooded legs dangled uselessly, and his pillion passenger, who had heavily bandaged arms, was working the foot pedals. All along the way were discarded greatcoats, left there by men too hot to carry them. Turner had already talked the corporals out of leaving theirs. They had been going for an hour when they heard behind them a rhythmic thudding, like the ticking of a gigantic clock. They turned to look back. At first sight, it seemed that an enormous horizontal door was flying up the road toward them. It was a platoon of Welsh guards in good order, rifles at the slope, led by a second lieutenant. They came by at a forced march, their gaze fixed forward, their arms swinging high. The stragglers stood aside to let them through. These were cynical times, but no one risked a catcall. The show of discipline and cohesion was shaming. It was a relief when the guards had pounded out of sight and the rest could resume their introspective trudging. The sights were familiar. The inventory was the same. But now there was more of everything. Vehicles, bomb craters, detritus. There were more bodies. He walked across the land until he caught the taste of the sea, carried across the flat, marshy fields on a freshening breeze. The one-way flow of people with a single purpose, the constant self-important traffic in the air, the extravagant cloud advertising their destination, suggested to his tired but overactive mind some long-forgotten childhood treat, a carnival or sports event, on which they were all converging. There was a memory that he could not place, of being carried on his father's shoulders up a hill toward a great attraction, toward the source of a huge excitement. He would like those shoulders now. His missing father had left few memories. a knotted neck scarf, a certain smell, the vaguest outline of a brooding, irritable presence. Did he avoid serving in the Great War, or did he die somewhere near here, under another name? Perhaps he survived. Grace was certain he was too cowardly, too shifty to join up, but she had her own reason to be bitter. Nearly every man here had a father who remembered northern France or was buried in it. He wanted such a father, dead or alive. Long ago, before the war, before Wandsworth, he used to revel in his freedom to make his own life, devise his own story with only the distant help of Jack Tallis. Now he understood how conceited a delusion this was. Rootless, therefore futile. He wanted a father, and for the same reason he wanted to be a father. It was common enough to see so much death and want a child. Common, therefore human, and he wanted it all the more. When the wounded were screaming, you dreamed of sharing a little house somewhere, of an ordinary life, a family line, connection. All around him men were walking silently with their thoughts, reforming their lives, making resolutions. If I ever get out of this lot... They could never be counted, the dreamed-up children, mentally conceived on the walk into Dunkirk and later made flesh. He would find Cecilia. Her address was on the letter in his pocket next to the poem. In the deserts of the heart, let the healing fountains start. He would find his father, too. They were supposed to be good at tracking down missing persons, the Salvation Army. A perfect name. He would track down his father or his dead father's story. Either way, he would become his father's son. They walked all afternoon until at last, a mile ahead, where grey and yellow smoke billowed up from surrounding fields, they saw the bridge across the Bergfern Canal. All the way in now, not a farmhouse or barn was left standing. As well as smoke, a miasma of rotting meat drifted toward them. More slaughtered cavalry horses, hundreds of them in a heap in a field. Not far from them was a smouldering mountain of uniforms and blankets. A beefy lance corporal with a sledgehammer was smashing typewriters and mimeograph machines. Two ambulances were parked at the side of the road, their back doors open. From inside came the groans and shouts of wounded men. One of them was crying out, over and over, more enraged than pain, "Water! I want water!" Like everyone else, Turner kept going. The crowds were bunching up again. In front of the canal bridge was a junction, and from the Dunkirk direction, on the road that ran along the canal, came a convoy of 3-ton lorries, which the military police were trying to direct into a field beyond where the horses were. But troops swarming across the road forced the convoy to a halt. The drivers leaned on their horns and shouted insults. The crowd pressed on. Men, tired of waiting, scrambled off the backs of the lorries. There was a shout of, "Take cover!" And before anyone could even glance round, the mountain of uniforms was detonated. It began to snow tiny pieces of dark green surge. Nearer, a detachment of artillerymen were using hammers to smash up the dial sights and breech blocks of their guns. One of them, Turner noticed, was crying as he destroyed his howitzer. At the entrance to the same field, a chaplain and his clerk were dousing cases of prayer books and Bibles with petrol. Men were crossing the field toward a naffy dump, looking for cigarettes and booze. When a shout went up, dozens more left the road to join them. One group sat by a farm gate, trying on new shoes. A soldier with crammed cheeks pushed past Turner with a box of pink and white marshmallows. 100 yards away, a dump of Wellington boots, gas masks and capes was fired, and acrid smoke enveloped the line of men pushing forward to the bridge. At last the lorries were on the move and turned into the biggest field immediately south of the canal. Military police were organizing the parking, lining up the rows like stewards at a county show. The lorries were joining half-tracks, motorbikes, Bren gun carriers and mobile kitchens. The disabling methods were, as always, simple. A bullet in the radiator and the engine left running until it seized up. The bridge was held by the Coldstream guards. Two neatly sandbagged machine gun posts covered the approach. The men were clean-shaven, stone-eyed, silently contemptuous of the filthy, disorganized rabble trailing by. On the other side of the canal, evenly spaced, white-painted stones marked out a path to a hut being used as an orderly room. On the far bank to the east and west, the guards were well dug in along their section. Waterfront houses had been commandeered, roof tiles punched out, and windows sandbagged for machine gun slits. A fierce sergeant was keeping order on the bridge. He was sending back a lieutenant on a motorbike. Absolutely no equipment or vehicles allowed. A man with a parrot in a cage was turned away. The sergeant was also pulling out men for perimeter defense duties, and doing it with far more authority than the poor major. A growing detachment stood unhappily at ease by the orderly room. Turner saw what was happening at the same time as the corporals, when they were still a good way back. "They'll fucking have you, mate," Mace said to Turner. "Poor bloody infantry. If you want to go home to the crumpet, get between us and limp." Feeling dishonourable but determined all the same, he put his arms round the corporal's shoulders and they staggered forward.
"It's your left, remember, Governor?" Nettle said. "Would you like me to pop my bayonet through your foot?"
"Thanks awfully. I think I can manage." Turner let his head droop as they were crossing the bridge, so he saw nothing of the duty sergeant's ferocious gaze, though he felt its heat. He heard the barked command, "Here, you!" Some unfortunate just behind him was pulled out to help hold off the onslaught, which must surely come within 2 or 3 days, while the last of the BEF was piling into the boats. What he did see while his head was lowered was a long black barge slipping under the bridge in the direction of Fern in Belgium. The boatman sat at his tiller smoking a pipe, looking stolidly ahead. Behind him, 10 miles away, Dunkirk burned. Ahead, in the prow, two boys were bending over an upturned bike, mending a puncture, perhaps. A line of washing, which included women's smalls, was hanging out to dry. The smell of cooking, of onions and garlic, rose from the boat. Turner and the corporals crossed the bridge and passed the whitewashed rocks, a reminder of training camp and all the bull. In the orderly hut, a phone was ringing. Mace murmured,
"You bloody well limp till we're out of sight."
But the land was flat for miles, and there was no telling which way the sergeant might be looking, and they didn't like to turn around to check. After half an hour, they sat down on a rusty seed drill and watched the defeated army walk by. The idea was to get in among a completely fresh crowd, so that Turner's sudden recovery did not attract the attention of an officer. A lot of men who passed were irritated at not finding the beach just beyond the canal. They seemed to think it was a failure of planning. Turner knew from the map there were another 7 miles, and once they were on the move again, they were the hardest, the dreariest they had walked that day. The wide, featureless land denied all sense of progress. Though the late afternoon sun was slipping through the trailing edges of the oil cloud, it was warmer than ever. They saw planes high over the port dropping their bombs. Worse, there were Stuka attacks right over the beach they were heading toward. They passed the walking wounded who could go no further. They sat like beggars at the side of the road calling out for help or for a mouthful of water. Others just lay by the ditch, unconscious or lost in hopelessness. Surely there would be ambulances coming up from the defence perimeter, making regular runs to the beach. If there was time to whitewash rocks, there must be time to organize that. There was no water, They had finished the wine, and now their thirst was all the greater. They carried no medicines. What were they expected to do? Carry a dozen men on their backs when they could barely walk themselves? In sudden petulance, Corporal Nettle sat down in the road, took off his boots, and flung them into a field. He said he hated them. He fucking hated them more than all the fucking Germans put together. And his blisters were so bad, he was better off with fuck all. "It's a long way to England in your socks," Turner said. He felt weirdly light-headed as he went into the field to search. The first boot was easy to find, but the second took him a while. At last he saw it lying in the grass near a black furry shape that seemed, as he approached, to be moving or pulsing. Suddenly a swarm of bluebottles rose into the air with an angry, whining buzz, revealing the rotting corpse beneath. He held his breath, snatched the boot, and as he hurried away, the flies settled back down and there was silence again. After some coaxing, Nettle was persuaded to take back his boots, tie them together and carry them round his neck. But he did this, he said, only as a favour to Turner. It was in his clear moments he was troubled. It wasn't the wound, though it hurt at every step, and it wasn't the dive bombers circling over the beach some miles to the north. It was his mind. Periodically, something slipped. Some everyday principle of continuity, the humdrum element that told him where he was in his own story, faded from his use, abandoning him to a waking dream in which there were thoughts, but no sense of who was having them. No responsibility, no memory of the hours before, no idea of what he was about, where he was going, what his plan was. And no curiosity about these matters. He would then find himself in the grip of illogical certainties. He was in this state as they came round the eastern edge of the resort after 3 hours' walking. They went down a street of shattered glass and broken tiles where children were playing and watching the soldiers go by. Nettle had put his boots back on, but he had left them loose with the laces trailing. Suddenly, like a jack-in-a-box, a lieutenant from the Dorsets popped up from the cellar of a municipal building that had been requisitioned for a headquarters. He came toward them at a self-important clip with an attaché case under his arm. When he stopped in front of them, they saluted. Scandalized, he ordered the corporal to tie his laces immediately or face a charge. While the corporal knelt to obey, the lieutenant, round-shouldered, bony, with a desk-bound look and a wisp of ginger moustache, said, "You're a bloody disgrace, man!" In the lucid freedom of his dream state, Turner intended to shoot the officer through the chest. It would be better for everybody. It was hardly worth discussing the matter in advance. He reached for it, but his gun had gone, he couldn't remember where, and the lieutenant was already walking away. After minutes of noisy crunching over glass, there was sudden silence under their boots where the road ended in fine sand. As they rose through a gap in the dunes, they heard the sea and tasted a salty mouthful before they saw it. The taste of holidays. They left the path and climbed through the dune grass to a vantage point where they stood in silence for many minutes. The fresh, damp breeze off the channel restored him to clarity. Perhaps it was nothing more than his temperature rising and falling in fits. He thought he had no expectations until he saw the beach. He'd assumed that the cussed army spirit which whitewashed rocks in the face of annihilation would prevail. He tried to impose order now on the random movement before him and almost succeeded. Marshalling centres, warrant officers behind makeshift desks, rubber stamps and dockets, roped off lines toward the waiting boats, hectoring sergeants, tedious queues around mobile canteens. In general, an end to all private initiative. Without knowing it, that was the beach he had been walking to for days. But the actual beach, the one he and the corporals gazed on now, was no more than a variation on all that had gone before. There was a route, and this was its